CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, we'll be bringing you an interview with Blake Frederick, the AMS Associate Vice President and UBC Student Senator, talking with him about changes to the campus bus loop proposal. We'll also be bringing you coverage of a recent campus visit made by Ben White, talking about his new book, Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide. Rafi Rizik spoke to students on both sides to see how the Israel-Palestine conflict is viewed on campus. Finally, our own Andrew Longhurst this week talked to NDP MP Bruce Heyer about the NDP's controversial climate change bill, C-311, which aims to hold Canada accountable to specific greenhouse gas reduction targets and reduce carbon emissions. We'll have all this, plus arts and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. This afternoon, our own Megan Turcotto had the pleasure of speaking to Blake Frederick, the AMS Associate VP and Student Senator, about proposed changes to the UBC bus loop and why he turned down an offer of Olympics tickets from the Olympics Secretariat.
So this week, we learned that TransLink announced they don't have the funds to complete the bus loop, and the university announced they won't be going ahead without TransLink. What is the AMS reaction to this announcement?
The AMS and students at large have been making it clear to the university since day one that this project was flawed and misguided. We are quite pleased to learn that the project will not be going forward. There were a number of significant problems with the project that were never addressed, the foremost of which being the fact that the capacity for the underground bus loop was not at a level that would actually meet the transit needs of students on campus. So we're quite happy that the bus loop will not be going forward.
Is there a pressing need on campus for a new bus loop?
There is certainly pressing need for vastly increased transit service both to and from campus. I think students recognize that transit service right now is inadequate, and the bus loop might not be meeting the needs that we have for increased bus service to campus. So the university has said that the bus loop as it is right now is a temporary solution, and they are, now that they've canceled the underground bus loop, they are going to go ahead and find a different solution for what will work on campus. There have been numerous studies done on this, actually. Some studies have come up with 19 different options for transit solutions on campus, most of which include a central bus loop. Some include actually buses circulating around the campus. What we need to focus on now is, now that the university's re-envisioning how transit is going to work on campus, we're making sure that they're going to consult with students very, very carefully before making any decisions.
Is there any kind of transportation plan which we'd like to see the school adopt over others?
I think that's up for the students to decide, in all honesty. The students did not have a say in the... There was no consultation process for the underground bus loop, and that's part of the reason why it raised such a large amount of concern that it did. And I think that the primary users of transit, the students, should be the ones making the decision for what transit is going to look like on campus.
So there's also been some concern raised by the AMS about how much money has previously been spent on the bus loop. Can you speak a little bit about that?
So I've confirmed that $6 million has been spent on the utilities work and road work in the area where the tunnel is now. It's the area that's currently fenced off. In addition, $400,000 has gone into design fees for the underground bus loop and the tunnel. Not to mention the 6 years of university time that has gone into this project. It's very unfortunate that that some of this funding will now go to waste. I think it signals to the university that they need to do a more careful job of consulting students before going ahead with a project of this type.
Well, to be fair, the university has stated that only $400,000 has been spent on the project so far. I guess they would say that the other road work and utilities were things that were needed anyway?
Yes, that's what they have indicated. But as I've also made clear, a single dollar that's been spent on this project is a dollar too much, given the wide-ranging student opposition to the project.
So can you just clear up something that I don't really understand? What kind of construction has already gone forward on this project?
It has been so it's just been the construction work on the utilities all last year. Mm-hmm. Students may have noticed that there were construction vehicles outside in the fenced off square area. They were moving some dirt around, but they didn't actually start major construction on the project, thankfully, because of the uncertainty in funding from TransLink. So the majority of the work has just been done on the utility work.
On another topic, someone was, when I said I was going to interview you, they were wanted me to ask you about that you were offered Olympic tickets in exchange for, I guess, maybe more positive messaging about the Olympics. Is this true? Can you confirm this story?
Yes, I can confirm that story. The Olympic Secretariat personally offered myself and a guest tickets to the Olympic Games at the Thunderbird venue arena. These tickets are obviously highly coveted and highly valued. I made clear to the Secretariat that it might not be appropriate for me to accept such a gift. Mm. And I indicated to her that I'd be more comfortable accepting them if they were transferable. That is, I could share it with other students, so that students who want to go see the games would have the opportunity to do that. Since that was not a possibility, I did not feel it was appropriate for me to accept the gift.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay. Have a great day.
Thanks, Megan, for bringing us that story. It's time now for some public service announcements, but stay tuned. We've got more local and national news next. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story to touch lives.
Hip-hop artist Emmanuel Jal, once a child soldier in Sudan, has returned to his home country, and this time his weapon is a microphone. His unique story and effort to build peace, War Child, is just one of the 25 films featured this year at the Amnesty International Film Festival, November 12th to 15th at the Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Full program available at amnestyfilmfest.ca. Brought to you in part by CITR Radio.
Me, I got a reason for being on this earth, cause I know more than many what's up. Life is worth enough. Now that I get a chance to stand my ground, I'm gonna run over mountains, leaps and bounds.
You people feel like making some noise tonight?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, Cookie Monster's favorite radio station.
Good night, Chicago! Brutal!
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Earlier this month, Ben White, author of Israeli Apartheid, Beginner's Guide, spoke on campus. Rafi Reitznik was there, speaking to students about their views of the Israel-Palestine conflict.
This is Rafi speaking on behalf of CITR inside the math building on a Wednesday evening, awaiting the arrival of a guest speaker by the name of Ben White. Ben White visits on behalf of the organization Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. I am here this evening to see just what will unfold and who this visitation attracts. Ben White has written a book, Israel Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, and has come to UBC to discuss the book and the issues it raises about the relationship between Israel and Palestinians. I spoke to the members of the audience to hear their impressions of the talk. I'm here with Nadine inside the math building. Now, Nadine, how did you hear of this event this evening?
Well, I'm part of the club SBHR, so we've been planning this for a couple of weeks now, and basically that's how I know about it.
I see. So, Nadine, what do you expect to hear this evening from our guest speaker?
I expect to hear very personal experience front up from Ben White. He's been to Palestine, he's been there a lot of times, he knows about the conflict, and he's just going to bring us some reality right to us right here in Canada.
So I assume you're familiar with the subject, am I correct?
Yes, I am Palestinian myself.
Thank you very much, Nadine. I'm here with Sean inside the math building. Now, Sean, how did you hear of this event this evening?
I was working at an Amnesty International booth, and I saw another booth that had the SBHR, and they were advertising it.
I see. Now, Sean, what do you expect from this lecture this evening?
I expect to be more informed about what is going on in Israel with the Gaza Strip and West Bank.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you came here to inform yourself better of
right.
this subject.
Yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sean.
Yeah.
So here I am upon the completion of the lecture with Ben White himself. Now, Ben White, after the very informative lecture, could you just give us a short summary of your book and why you've written it?
Sure. Well, I wrote Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, to provide a brief and accessible summary of what Israeli policies have meant for the Palestinians over the last 60 years, and to really particularly explain the way in which Israel has attempted and maintained a regime of domination, securing land and resources for one group at the expense of another.
Great, and sorry, one more quick question. Do you plan to do another lecture elsewhere, or perhaps at another university in the future?
Sure. This talk tonight here in Vancouver, it's part of a national tour organized by SBHR, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights. So I'm going to a variety of other cities as well. I think it's about 10 venues.
I'm here with Nader at the conclusion of the lecture. Now, Nader, was this lecture as you expected it might be?
Yes, it was a very good lecture. A lot of common misconceptions were answered, and a lot of basis for the conflict was addressed through the event. And that's mainly the basic goal that we were trying to achieve here. And I think it was addressed very well by Ben White.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you do think that Ben Wright achieved his goals here today?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And through the question and answer period, we saw a lot of the common misconceptions or problems that come out always, or the questions that are often asked, were asked again today, and they were addressed very well, basically, by Ben Wright.
Okay, thank you very much, Nader.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm here in front of the sub-building by the tabling by the IAC, the Israel Awareness Club. And I'm here with Noam. Noam, having attended the lecture, what was your overall impression of Ben White's presentation?
I was disappointed. It's just another demonstration of another SBHR event that I feel the main objective was to vilify Israel, show Israel as a baby killer, show a twisted reality, and a truly one-sided view on the conflict. And I just feel that Ben White tried to increase hatred. People didn't get the chance to hear the full side of the story, and I'm disappointed that presentations of this kind get staged at UBC.
Noam, did you feel that the questions were addressed in the right manner upon the completion of the lecture?
The questions that the students asked and the way they asked it was respectful. I think some of Ben White's answer was a bit trying to not answer directly the question, avoiding it, but it didn't surprise me. I remember my question when I asked him about Israel's positive efforts and humanitarian aid to the Palestinian community through the Gaza war, for example, doing 200,000 phone calls, radio warnings, pamphlets, giving medicine, helping the civilians, taking refugees. I asked him to give those examples because I wanted people to hear there is another side. And Israel is not a baby killer army, it's an army that is operating according to an ethical code. And White's response was basically saying, yes, there was some. And obviously it's very hard for him to admit Israel is doing great efforts. And he also said that it's for Israel's own benefit. And that connects to everything, like this idea of trying to vilify Israel, showing them in such a bad light, which is completely not connected to what's really going on in the Middle East.
Thank you, Noam. Thank you for your response.
Thanks.
Now, I'm here with Yoni upon the completion of this lecture. Now Yoni, what was your overall impression of Ben White's presentation?
I thought that Ben White was very one-sided in his analysis of the current situation. He emphasized greatly, disproportionately, the Palestinian living conditions, Palestinian situation, but neglected to even mention the Israeli living conditions having to live, especially under the Intifada that he was focusing on. He neglected to mention that Israelis were living under constant fear of Palestinian terrorism. Israelis couldn't congregate in public because suicide bombings were almost a weekly occurrence, a daily occurrence, excuse me. And I think either this neglect from Ben White, either it reflects kind of a blatant anti-Israel bias, or simply reflects his ignorance of the historical necessities that resulted in Israel's setting up this system. And that ignorance might have come about because Ben White is nothing more than an English lit major, bachelor, and that's it's silly that he is even touring Canadian campuses, because quite frankly I have similar credentials. I could just be equally up to the task to tour and give my opinion on the situation. I've been there before too, you know.
Thank you very much for your comments, Yoni.
Thank you.
While some students felt that presentations like this are not suitable for a campus environment, it seems to have raised a healthy debate on issues which are current and relevant for much of the student body, both in a personal and political sense.
Thanks, Rafi, for bringing us that coverage. Last weekend, 6,000 Vancouverites gathered on the Cambie Street Bridge to push for Canada to change its response to the current climate crisis. Vlad Pepink and Elias Omid were there and bring us this report.
On Saturday, October 24th, 2009, thousands of people in Cambie Bridge in Vancouver gathered to convey their message for Canadian government and international community to take an action for climate change. Here, one of the organizers, Rubaki Beatnin, has said.
The solution to this massive problem needs to be just as massive as the problem itself, and that needs to be a huge movement. And I think that begins with students, a huge movement that changes the way we live. And we need to call our government to action, and this is a very, very important time right now, and today is very, very important because of the UN Climate Summit happening in December.
UBC students were part of this event on October 24th on Cambie Bridge in Vancouver. Among 5,200 events which took place in 181 countries. We also spoke with a bunch of people. One of the participants was Lauren, and she explains why she's there and what is her message.
I'm here because I support climate action, because without it, I saw a t-shirt here that said my favorite endangered species is me, and that's the truth of it. So I have grandchildren and I have children, and I want there to be a world for them to be in.
I also spoke with Jackie and Shirley, UBC students, about their expectations for this event.
Starting at about noon, which is sooner now, we're having an official welcome, and then there's going to be a banner drop, and we're going to march to Science World in solidarity with people around the world who are taking action on climate change today.
I'm dressed up like a sea turtle today, and I did that for fun, and also because I wanted to help draw attention to the event that we're having here today, and try and make it a big, beautiful spectacle for the media. And it's not just animals, and it's all people around the world that are endangered by climate change and the effects that it will have on all of us, and so I just wanted to draw attention to that. My message is that I think it's critically important that there be cooperation in Copenhagen this year around effectively addressing climate change in a way that we haven't to this point, and not just talking about it, but actually coming up with some practical solutions that we can apply and that we are committed to apply as an international community, because this is an international problem.
Yes. Yeah, good. We are at Cambi Bridge, and we are interviewing Andrea Carr, the deputy party of Green Party in Canada. And we will we would like to hear from her first. I would like to her to introduce. And then my second question is why she is here and what is her message for the international community.
Okay, I'm here on the bridge because I want to be part of this global day of action. To draw attention to the climate issue and to demand that governments around the world take action, take real serious action. I'm particularly concerned that Canada has become a laggard, has not taken action, and it's an embarrassment to me. So I want to see our federal government policy change and put us on the path that will be indeed good for the issue of climate change.
Okay, thanks. And what is your message for international community, or what's your demand when you are one of the participants of this event? So what is going to be your message for the Canadian government and international community, or what's going to be your demand?
Okay, my message from the Green Party to our federal government in Canada is stop sabotaging global climate talks, which Canada has done. And number two, stop fooling around and doing little on the issue of climate change within Canada. Invest in renewable energy, invest in energy conservation, make a firm commitment to bring down the greenhouse gas emissions in Canada to the levels needed, which are 95% below 1990 levels by the year 2050, and we have no time to lose. We have to act now.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrea Carr, and have a good day.
Okay, thanks.
I also met two elementary school age, Adam and Benjamin, who were part of the event and talked to us.
Well, we're here to save the planet and... What? Okay, we are here today to show people that we should stop wasting and make help the environment to not pollute and stop global warming.
This was the report of international climate change, which took place on Cambi Bridge in Vancouver on October 24, 2009. In the event, there were many people from different institutions and different age groups. We are looking forward to see what is going to happen in Copenhagen Climate Change Summit in December.
Thanks to Brad and Elias for bringing us that report. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you an interview with NDP MP Bruce Heyer about the NDP's recent climate change bill. All that right after these public service announcements.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
Do you feel like the issues you care about are trivialized in the mainstream press? Want a media that isn't afraid to step on the toes of corporate interests? profit-driven media leaving you without the information you need to properly exercise your franchise? Then Media Democracy Day is for you. On Saturday, November 7th, come down to the Vancouver Public Library, located at 350 West Georgia Street, to celebrate Media Democracy Day. You'll have the opportunity to talk to Vancouver journalists who are producing alternative news and hear informative panel discussions about democratizing our media. This is your chance to learn more about how power and profits drive reporting. Protest the status quo and call for change. Okay. In part by CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:25. This week, there's been a lot of push and pull in Ottawa over the NDP's Bill C-311, their climate change bill. With the support of the Bloc Québécois, but not the Liberals, the bill has an uncertain fate, but it proposes to reduce Canada's carbon emissions and bring us closer in line with our international commitments around climate change. Our own Andrew Longhurst spoke with NDP environment critic Bruce Heyer.
Hi, my name is Bruce Heyer. I'm the Member of Parliament for Thunder Bay Superior North. I'm an NDP rookie in the House of Parliament. And I, this year, introduced a private member's bill, Bill C-311, which is called the Climate Change Accountability Act, which is a science-based bill. It's not based on politics. It's not based on opinions. Or if it's based on opinions, it's based on the opinions of 2,500 top scientists from around the world who are on the IPCC, which stands for the International Panel on Climate Change, which advises the United Nations on climate issues. When I say it's a science-based bill, it takes the opinions and the science of those scientists and turns their recommendations for the minimum that is needed to be done and turns it into law to pretty much force this and future governments to do what is necessary to keep our increases in global climate change to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius. Now, how does it do that? It does not prescribe how. It doesn't get into carbon capture and storage versus cap and trade versus anything else. That will come later. What it does is it establishes 1990 as a base year, partly because that's a convention, but also by using 1990 as a base year, we don't penalize those countries and those industries and those corporations who've already stepped up to the plate and reduced their greenhouse gases as per the Kyoto Accord. It takes that base year of 1990, and it requires, in an orderly fashion, through a process, that over the next 11 years, in 2020, that we have a reduction from 1990 levels for greenhouse gases of 25%. Then in 2050, which is 41 years from now, the target would be an 80% reduction from 1990 targets. So they're very significant reductions, but according to the scientists, it's the minimum that we need to do in order to save our planet, or at least save our civilization. The planet will probably survive, but many species, including our own, probably won't if we don't heed the call of these scientists.
And why is it so essential that we have this type of legislation in Canada?
It's essential that we have this legislation for many reasons. One is for investor confidence. Another is so that we have a plan, a strategy, and then a mechanism for getting to the targets that we need to meet. It's necessary because a number of governments, both Liberal and Conservative governments, over the last several decades have paid lip service, in the case of the Liberals, and not even that in the case of the Conservatives, to the need to reduce greenhouse gases, but have not stepped up to the plate and done what is needed to make sure that we get there. So the Liberal government, the previous Liberal governments, committed to Kyoto reductions, and instead of reductions, of course, we had huge increases. So Canada is way at the back of the pack We're the worst greenhouse gas polluters in the world. We emit more greenhouse gases per capita than any other nation on Earth, and that's not all about having a cold climate. It's about not getting serious. So all of us need to get serious from the top to the bottom, from the average person on the street and in the car and on the bicycle all the way up to the Prime Minister. And so this sets out clear targets that hopefully we will meet.
And just going back to your previous comment, why is there this myth that Canada, at least globally, there's a perception that Canada is doing its part? And I think that myth, I don't exactly know where that myth is coming from. Can you speak to that?
Well, globally, there's no such myth. People all around the globe know that Canada and the United States are a total failure on controlling greenhouse gases. There's a myth in Canada that we're doing our part, and so nothing works in politics, at least in the short term, for some people sometime, like the big lie. And so pretending that we're doing our part is just simply not true. We're not only way behind the pack, we're getting further behind the pack all the time. So this bill would move us from the back of the pack to the front of the pack, at least in principle.
So give me a little bit of background, too, about do other countries have similar legislation on the books? Is this something that would put us in line with legislation in other countries, in other European countries, for example?
I don't know the answer to that question. I wish I did. I know that other countries have made the commitments, politically, but whether they've backed it up with hard legislation like this, I'm not absolutely certain. I'll hold on just 1 minute, Andrew.
Okay.
The one exception that I am aware of is that the United Kingdom has enacted in legislation targets that are even more stringent than the ones we're talking about in Bill C-311.
Okay.
But other than the United Kingdom, I think it's been mostly treaties, agreements, political promises, both written and verbal. The only one that's really put their legislation where their mouth is the United Kingdom, as far as I know.
Right. And so the NDP is really trying to get this bill passed before the conference in Copenhagen coming up in December. And why is it so important that this is passed prior to that conference?
Well, I don't see this as an NDP bill. I like to think of it as a bipartisan bill, a nonpartisan bill. Some of the Liberals, most of the Liberals in their hearts support it. They voted for it at second reading. All of the Bloc voted for it at second reading, and all of the NDP voted for it at second reading, and the Conservatives are not likely in our lifetimes to vote for it. It's really not about right versus left. It's really about right versus wrong in the future of the planet. So it's a private member's bill, not an NDP bill. And I hope, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe at some point the Conservatives will even come on side. A number of Conservatives have said to me, well, Mr. Heyer, we don't really need a bill like this because carbon capture and storage are going to take care of the problem. And we're investing money and technology in carbon capture and storage in Alberta, and that'll take care of it. And I come back with, great, if that'll take care of it, then this bill shouldn't bother you at all. If you're really confident that we can do it through carbon capture and storage or any method, then you should be supporting these targets. Because the Prime Minister has agreed publicly, when he met last with the G8, keep our temperature increases to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius. According to the scientists, if we're really going to meet that target of not more than a 2 degrees Celsius increase, we have got to reduce our greenhouse gases on the order of magnitude or more of what's in this bill.
But why has there been such opposition? You mentioned that this shouldn't be viewed as an NDP bill. This should be something that should be widely accepted by all the parties. But yet the Liberals, a number of the Liberals and the Conservatives largely, are in complete opposition to this bill.
Well, when I talk to Liberals privately, most of them agree with the targets in this bill and want to vote for it. a significant part of the, I'm guessing, and you should ask these people, call them and ask them. But two of the people that are sending the Liberals, at least in the short term, down the wrong path on this are David McGuinty, the environment critic, who has dragged discussion on this bill at crucial times into in-camera sessions in the Environment Committee. And the other one is Iggy, who you may recall only a few days after he was made the new leader of the Liberals, made his little trip, his pilgrimage to Alberta to say that he totally supported the oil sands and the future of the oil sands was the future of Canada and we needed it economically. I think that whether it's Iggy from the top down or David McGuinty misleading his party on the costs and benefits of this bill, I think most Liberals in their hearts really do want to vote for it.
Mm-hmm. So what happens, though, if this bill doesn't pass?
Well, besides me personally going into major depression, literally, clinically, for me this is a real litmus test. If this bill passes, I'll be encouraged, and I'll think, my goodness, maybe Canada is going to come into the 21st century. Maybe we will meet our responsibilities and we'll collectively move forward as the vast majority of Canadians want us to. If our government is unable and unwilling to do what Canadians and people around the world want, which is to take our civilization out of risk and move decisively to a more sustainable energy base for our economy, then I will be greatly encouraged. So now, in the bigger picture, that's me personally, and I think there are a lot of people who agree. If this bill doesn't pass, and there may be other opportunities, but the clock is ticking. We've been dealing with this since the late 80s and the early 90s, and we've been waffling and postponing and delaying again and again and again and again, and it's just time to get with the program.
Right. Well, this comes as we just saw some of the largest demonstrations calling Canada to take action against climate change this past week, and you also, I'm sure, are present for the student demonstration in the gallery of the House. What are your feelings towards some of this? Do you think this is long overdue, some of these demonstrations, and just the anger that we're seeing, especially a lot of young people exhibiting?
Well, we Canadians are very polite people. And Canadian environmentalists are way more polite than German and American and other environmentalists. And so for weeks and months and years and decades now, environmentalists collectively and individually have been going to our rulers and saying, please, sir, could we please save the planet? And then the leaders say, well, no, we think it'll cost too much, or we'll study it for another decade or two. And then many of the environmentalists have gone away and said, oh, well, we just thought we'd ask. Yes, some are getting more strident now, and I guess you'll have to decide for yourself whether that's the right way to go. I can certainly understand their frustration. If I weren't a member of Parliament, I don't know if I'd be in Parliament doing that kind of demonstration, but I'd certainly be on the streets doing that kind of demonstration. Mm-hmm. It's time that we all had a wake-up call and took our responsibilities to each other, to our fellow humans, to our fellow species, and to our planet seriously.
Mm-hmm. Are there any last comments you want to leave our listeners with?
Just that I'd like to underscore again that this bill is not prescriptive in terms of how we do it. It simply sets the minimum targets that scientists tell us we need to avoid dangerous greenhouse gas increases. And once it's passed, then hopefully the governments will accept that those are the targets, and then we all will shift to figuring out the dozens, hundreds, perhaps thousands of technological, political, social, and economic ways in which we can reach these targets. So it doesn't prescribe how, it simply sets the stage for us all to put on our thinking caps and do what's required to make it happen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Heyer, for your time. Appreciate it, and good luck on the passage of this bill.
Well, good luck to all of us on the fate of our civilization and the planet.
Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Andrew.
Take care.
Bye.
Thanks, Andrew, for bringing us that story. It's now time for the Arts Report, and for that we go to Tracy Fuller. This week, Tracy spoke with Ryan Gladstone, the director of Here Be the Monsters 4, which is playing tonight and Saturday on Granville Island.
Can you tell me, what is Here Be Monsters for, and what should people be looking forward to this weekend on Granville Island at Performance Works?
Sure. Here Be Monsters is actually our fourth year of producing festivals, and it's a collective of artists that are, I guess, trying our hand at producing. But so this year, the whole festival is focused on one aspect, which is Theater Under the Gun, which is actually in its 11th year. And it's we've been running it in conjunction with our festival for 4 years. But basically what it is we have 10 different theater companies that we give them inspiration packages. We're giving the first ones out tonight, actually, in a couple hours.
Excellent.
And they get 48 hours to basically create, write, produce a play. Mm. And then they go up on Friday and Saturday nights, 30th and 31st, and it's going to be so much fun. It's always just full of incredible energy and so much fun. So,
is it a judged competition? Is the point for one theater company to win something, or is it just a whole group of people getting together and seeing how creative they can be?
Yeah, no, everyone wins. we've had a few years in past where our festival was longer, where we did sort of like holdovers. So the audience voted on their favorite one each night, and that show got to come back and go again. But not this year. This year, yeah, everyone wins. It's just fun to be there and soak up the energy of the young companies. And actually, this year we have some people. One of the companies, I think, has actually been in Theater Under the Gun like every single year. Hmm. You know, so there's lots of old vets this time around, which is fun.
So, are all the companies from Vancouver originally? Like, who are the people who are going to be involved?
Is there anyone who's from Vancouver originally? I'm not sure about that.
I know that you are originally from, that you at least did some of your schooling out in Alberta, so...
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Alberta, and me and my brother actually are two of the main members of Here Be Monsters. And, we're from Alberta, but, most of them are Vancouver companies.
Okay, and can you give us a sense of what kind of, what was in the inspiration packages that you sent out in previous years? What kind of things will people be receiving in order to create these new works?
It varies so much. One of the fun things that we've done before and we're doing again this year is that the other companies have to bring a prop.
Oh.
And then we hand those out, so we have no idea what those entail. In fact, One year, somebody brought like a jar full of what appeared to be feces.
Oh!
somebody had a full sized working motorcycle once.
Oh my gosh!
All sorts of stuff. So there's that. This year we have a stage direction.
Mm-hmm.
So then we give them a random stage direction that they have to incorporate a sound effect.
Right.
In the past, one of the things we did that was fun was a lighting cue.
Oh.
So they got one specific light or, you know, state that they had to incorporate into their play at some point. So
how long is each play?
About 15 minutes, but it depends. I mean, gosh, sometimes they go long, and some of them are short, but depends on the inspiration. And because it's such a limited time, you often don't have a lot of chance to run through it and find out how long it really is. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. There's definitely an element of the of surprise and of improv in all of this, it sounds.
Sure. I mean, to the companies as well as to the audience, there's surprise. and stuff works that you didn't think was going to work. There's just so much excitement in the audience, too, that it's one of the most fun places to perform, because they know you just wrote this last night, or you know. I was involved in a group once performing in the festival where we wrote our play and we kind of rehearsed it, and this was like towards, you know, we were about 30 hours into the 48-hour process, and then we were kind of like, I don't know, it's all right. What else could we do? And we scrapped everything that we had done.
Oh, my gosh.
And totally rewrote it, you know, and it turned out to be, you know, one of the best one of the best ones I've ever been involved with. It was totally hilarious.
I often wonder what it is about limited amounts of times. I mean, perhaps journalists say it all the time, and lots of artists say it, that there is no time like the last minute to get really creative ideas. What is it about that rushed sense or that limited amount of times that really brings out people's best in terms of creativity or boundary bending?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one thing is that people say yes. You don't have time to, like we always say, they're not waiting around for a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
They have the first idea that comes because you don't have time to debate it or think about how to make it better, you know. So so you just, people say yes and dive in with, fully clothed.
Or fully costumed, as it might be this year.
Yeah,
I'm sure you'll have quite a few Halloween-themed productions going up.
Absolutely, and there actually is a discount on tickets if you show up in costume as an audience member as well.
Excellent, excellent. So how about for people out there who are listening who might want to come, do they have to buy tickets in advance, or will they be available at the door? What's the deal?
You can buy tickets in advance at tickets tonight.ca.
Okay.
Or there will probably be tickets available at the door for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for taking some time to tell us about it, and I hope the performances go off really well.
Yes, I'm sure they will. I can't wait to see what they come up with.
Yeah, me too. Well, have a great Halloween.
Right on. You too.
And now with your weekend weather, here's Denise Diadic.
This is your Halloween weekend weather forecast from October 30th to November 1st. I hope you have no fun plans for the weekend at all, because it's going to snow. Lots. Actually, I'm just saying that to frighten you. Tonight we will see some rain showers, and it will be windy at times, but it won't be too cold, with a low of 9 degrees. Halloween Saturday will be cloudy, with a few sunny periods, also windy, with some showers possible in the morning and evening. High of 13, low of 5. This is much better than Vancouver's record low for Halloween, negative 5 degrees. Sunday, a low pressure system should be moving in, bringing rain towards evening. High of 11, low of 6. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Have a fun Halloween, stay safe, dress up as an anemometer, and bring a coat. Currently, it's 14 degrees and lightly raining at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diadic.
Thanks, Denise. And that's our program for October 30th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. From the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening. Thanks. Stay tuned for Thunderbird Sports here on CITR 101.9 FM.